for his rhythmic bass playing and for the way that he sings in octaves with his bowed bass solos. He's played with Charlie Parker, Teddy Wilson, Duke Ellington, Art Tatum, Ella Fitzgerald, to name a few. Major Holly will be with us live at 4 o'clock this afternoon, and he'll have his bass with him to do some playing for us. Every Wednesday at 3:30, we hear John's Wed's record show, Music on a Theme. Today, in the second of his three-part series on music from New Orleans, he'll play and discuss recordings by the group The Meters. Practically everything that we buy and everything that we own eventually becomes garbage, or at least gets put into the trash. But then what happens to it? Well, David Selvin followed the journey of garbage from its beginnings in the trash can sitting in the alley to its final resting place, wherever that is. We'll follow David Selvin on his journey with garbage at 3 o'clock today as we hear the documentary that he produced for NPR Journal. Many bicyclers are frustrated by what they're legally not allowed to do. There's bridges they're prevented from biking on, public transportation that they can't take their bikes on to, and drives and parkways that they can't use. At 2:30, we'll hear from two people who are working to change the rules in order to make city life easier for bicyclers. Ralph Hirsch is the National Legislative Director of the League of American Wheelmen, a bicycle lobby group. Bob Silverman is the founder of the Montreal bicycle group Le Monde Bicyclette. We'll be speaking with them both at about 2:30. With me now, back for a return visit to Fresh Air, is Philadelphia-based pianist and composer Heath Allen, who has performed at many clubs and performance places in Philadelphia, and has played off and on for the last few years with saxophonist and composer Steve Marcucci. For 5 years, Heath was affiliated with the Calvary United Methodist Church in West Philadelphia, where he was asked to write new liturgies. He was recently commissioned to create a ritual with dance and music in Basel, Switzerland. He now works with Cultural Harvest, a new arts group in residence at the Christian Association on the Penn campus. His new musical theater piece, Report on a Castaway, will be performed this weekend at the Susan Hess Studio at 2030 Sansom Street. Report on a Castaway was conceived by Heath with Chris Hayes and Aaron Williams. It's based on the poetry of Bertolt Brecht with music by Heath Allen. If you're interested in these performances at 2030 Sansom Street, they'll be happening Friday and Saturday at 8:30 in the evening, with a Sunday matinee at 2:30, and a little later I'll give you a number you can call for information. I'm going to be talking with Heath for the next while about his work creating new liturgies, as well as his musical theater piece that is playing now in Philadelphia. Well, Heath, welcome back to Fresh Air.
Thank you, Terry.
Before we talk about the work that you've recently been doing, it would be nice to listen to one of the tapes that you've brought with you of your music, and we'll be hearing an excerpt from the Brecht piece a little later, but we're going to open with a duet that you recorded with Steve Marcucci. Can you just set the mood or setting for us?
Certainly. This is from a series of concerts that Steve and I did of purely improvisational music, and you can sort of hear our process of improvising, where Steve will start off with a little motif and I answer back, and the call and answer back between us creates the piece. And since it is completely improvised, they're not titled until afterwards. We listen to the tapes and then we sit down and make titles for all of them, and this was post-named Remembering Duke.
Okay, well, let's hear it. Thank you. was a duet improvisation with my guest Heath Allen at the piano and Steve Marcucci on alto saxophone. Heath Allen is my guest, and Heath, you've been spending part of your time over the past few years creating new liturgies, so what's wrong with the old ones?
Well, for a lot of people, there's nothing wrong with the old ones. For myself, the old ones just weren't working. I was finding, I feel that there's a need for liturgy, whether you go to church or for rituals, just in people's lives in general, that we live a life that is really bereft of any meaningful ritual. And I can see people all over just attaching themselves to any possible thing which can serve as a ritual, like Rocky Horror Picture Show every Saturday night or anything. I mean, it just seems, I see a general need in our society for it. And so for a lot of people who are somewhat alienated, well, let's say in the Christian church, from a liturgy which is hundreds of years old and from a cosmology which is thousands of years old, there's still a need to have actions, ritual liturgical action, but without these antiquated symbols which might turn somebody off.
I think part of what people want to get from religion is a connection to the past. So how do you create new liturgy, maintaining some sense of connection, mm-hmm. but also changing mm-hmm. things to fit along with the tenor of the time?
I agree with that very much. And I think there's certain things which will always be with us that are especially things that are connected to symbols of the unconscious in an almost kind of Jungian way that are always going to be very powerful. For example, the bread and the wine. I mean, but you can take bread and wine in a lot of different ways. The piece I did over in Basel, Switzerland, that I was commissioned to do, there was dancing, there was music, there was a choir, there was no seats in this 12th century cathedral. We moved out all the chairs, it was just people in a big circle, and there was some interactive movement with the audience and creating this big rope, and then we brought in all this food at the end, and essentially it was a whole art event working up to a communal sharing of food and wine. And in a phenomenological way, it was built on the communion, which also phenomenologically is built upon a sacrifice rite. So if you look at things in a very basic phenomenological form, even though you might have what's called a new ritual, it's probably based on a very old form. And also the specific elements, like I mentioned, the bread and wine or fire or voice or words, whatever. I mean, there's these specific physical things which can be maintained the same and can give you that sense of history at the same time being put into a contemporary situation.
Did you find similarities amongst the people in Switzerland in terms of what they were alienated from in their religion and what Americans who are alienated from mm-hmm. their religion feel alienated about?
Yeah, there's a lot of similarities. I think in Switzerland, it's even an extreme. The church over there is essentially a government-supported museum. Nobody goes to church. It's not like America where the church has some kind of function in the society. The church is just totally away. In fact, we even had a really hard time even getting people to come in. But I think there are people really responded very strongly to this piece. We're very moved and very affected by it. And it was partly because it was during an election where they were trying to give foreign workers a certain modicum of civil rights that was defeated by a tremendous majority. And it was kind of the equivalent of the conservative landslide that happened here in the past presidential election. And so the ritual that I did over there was serving a double purpose as kind of being an alternative celebration even in the midst of defeat, that certain people were getting together in the midst of this great defeat and still finding some things in their own values that were worth holding up and celebrating. So just the timeliness of it proved to be very, very fortuitous.
Could you describe any of the work that you did at the Calvary Church in West Philadelphia?
Oh, I did. I did. It was. I had essentially a monthly composition assignment. It was a composer's dream. Every month, I was given essentially an hour worth of time and an audience, and a group of volunteers to work with whatever I wanted to do. And I did a lot of strange things. I put people in the balcony. I would have multi-voice readings, just using members of the congregation. And because you're not working with, it's not like you're working with talented musicians, but nonetheless, I'm working with creative, normal citizens who wanted to be involved in the creation of new liturgy and have to be involved in the creation of new liturgy. It's ritual is not something that one person can sit down and say, well, let's see, what is the new ritual that I'm going to create? Ritual comes out of a community. And I think this is what a lot of people don't understand. They go out and write a book or do studies on new ritual, but it doesn't exist outside of society. It has to come out of a neighborhood. And I was able to give some guidance as with my artistic skills, but it was very definitely a cooperative process.
Music functions really differently in a church than it does in a concert
mm-hmm.
hall.
Mm-hmm. It's I like it better. There's a lot of nice things about it. One thing about music in a church, of course, it can alienate people as well as connect people. It's been a long road for me to even get to a lot of members of the congregation where they can would openly listen to or open themselves to what was going on, because people, you know, like you said, there's certain people that are very satisfied with an old form of liturgy and don't want anything new in their church. And I think one of the good things about Calvary, it's a situation where we're trying to make both things exist at the same time. So one week there might be a very traditional thing and the next week there'd be something new. But there's a great satisfaction in people, in reaching people who are not necessarily music fans or not the sort of people who go out to a concert, but yet they're your neighbors. And someone, a woman who lives up the street from me, a 70-year-old woman, has probably never gone to a concert in her life, but comes up to me and says, your music just reaches me so much. I don't know what it is. I don't know anything about music, but somehow it just takes my heart on a little journey. There's just no comparison to the satisfaction that you get from a person responding to your music. Because they're listening without any judgment. They're not going to a club and going, is this hip? Is this the latest thing? Dig that modulation there. I don't like that 13th chord, you know, or whatever. You know, the kind of judgmental head that you get in when you go to a club. In an optimum situation among certain people, you can get in a situation where people are really listening because it's part of a greater whole. They listen without evaluation because it's feeding this greater whole, and it's the greater whole that they're concerned with. Does that make sense?
Oh, it makes perfect sense. Uh-huh. And what might be called a sing-along or audience participation, or, you know, involving the audience in your piece in a theater setting just becomes the service, because it's taken for granted that people participate in some way.
Right. And also involving people in the creative work preparing the service. I think this is something I always want to emphasize, and that's I want to make very much a part of my work as an artist. And with the play Report on a Castaway, that too came out of workshops just with neighborhood people, and I feel this is a very important thing to me now as an artist.
Let's talk about Report on a Castaway a little bit. Now that's coming up this weekend. It's the final performances this weekend on Sansom Street in Center City. And I guess you had been reading a lot of Brecht poetry before deciding to make a theater piece surrounding?
I made a very conscious decision that I wanted to be more political in my work as an artist.
Yeah, why, Heath?
Well, I think it's just something that I've always been very strongly political as an individual, just in my own private life. And I was beginning to feel this big distance between my artistic life, which a lot of it is in a as a jazz musician or as a musician, you're kind of in a servile role. I'm accompanying dance classes, so you're playing a club, and it's, oh, yes, sir, and autumn leaves, fine, sir, what is that, ma'am? Time after time, oh, I'll look at you, you don't have it? Oh, I'm sorry, I can't, you know, you're in this, I was in this role that just was not connected at all to what, let's say, the liturgical work I was doing in Calvary and just my own personal beliefs about the way I wanted to exist in a human society. So I just turned to Brecht because he has a reputation as the kind of political artist. It was no other reason than that. And I picked up, and somebody had told me about the new volume of poems that were first time a large group of his poems had been collected and translated into English into one volume. So I studied the poems and was particularly struck by the poems from the Svendborg period, which when he was on exile in an island of Denmark right after the Nazis took over. It was right before the war. And I was reading at the seashore, for one thing. So there is the kind of physical imagery, the water, the birds, whatever, that was in his environment was connected to mine. But I also felt that his talking about the growing militarism that he was seeing and was a similar time to my own. I feel that I just look around me and there's all this, you know, we're talking about blowing the world up and what's going on with the politically, you know, with this country and Latin America and all over the place. It's a very similar kind of time. And I think he was struggling with some questions that I was struggling with, which is here he is in exile, and yet he definitely also has kind of half himself he had left in Germany and still wants to be working, to be fighting the Nazis. He wants to still be working there. But yet, you're right, you're somewhere else, and there's things that can be done there. There's a poem where his son takes him away from the typewriter where he's writing this polemic against the war and brings him over to a little apricot tree outside that's freezing. He says, look, you know, and they put a bag over the freezing tree to protect the tree. And I think in that poem really epitomizes the struggle that I feel myself. I think a lot of us feel that we want to be active politically, but yet we want to take care of our families. We want to enjoy life. We want to live in the moment and not be so concerned with the kind of world we want to create or changing the world. It's a funny kind of paradox, and I think it's two sides of the coin in which we live.
When you write music for poems by Brecht, you're obviously working within a context where everybody's going to be thinking of Kurt Weill. Mm-hmm. Because everybody, when they think of Brecht, thinks of Weill also.
Sure.
And you, I'm sure, know their musical collaborations uh-huh. together. So what kinds of problems did that create for you, and how did you work around them?
Well, the very first piece I did of Brecht was so completely un-Kurt Weill that really helped me. The very first piece I set Report on a Castaway was just to a single line. It had a quality of a sea chanty, really. It was kind of Steve Reich sea chanty combination, which was so completely away from the cabaret atmosphere of Weill. So I feel that once the play started developing, I had these two streams, which is one, like you say, the traditional Brecht-Weill collaboration, that kind of thing, which you can't, like you mentioned, you can't help but being affected by that. But I felt that this one piece was such a little gem, this little sea shanty thing I did with a clarinet and the poem, that almost gave me another root that I could draw from. And I think maybe that the play combines those two roots. And one is very much myself. It's something that's more rooted, maybe something folky, almost oriental with a solitary clarinet. So I had those two different streams that I was working with.
Why don't we hear an excerpt of this theater piece? And this is one of the pieces that you wrote uh-huh. around one of Brecht's poems. Can you introduce it for us, Heath?
Yeah, this piece is called Hollywood Elegy. It's actually one of the few pieces. It's not from the Svendborg period. It's from when he lived in Hollywood during the war. But again, it deals with this, with the kind of personal struggle that I was talking about individual activism versus self-realization. And in this poem, the narrator is kind of wondering about a friend of his. You can think of it as a very Hollywood scene, a friend of his who has sold out, who he says is stuck in the mud. And it deals about that, well, first of all, the dilemma of what are you supposed to do with these friends who you see stuck in the mud. But also, I had two singers. I tried to bring out the kind of relativity of that maybe your friend who you think is stuck in the mud also thinks that you're stuck in the mud. And so I kind of emphasized that, too, in the poem.
Okay, well, let's hear this. The poem is by Bertolt Brecht, the music by my guest Heath Allen.
And the friend I loved most among them, helplessly stuck in a small
Just heard an excerpt of the musical theater piece Report on a Castaway with music by my guest Heath Allen and poems by Bertolt Brecht. The piece will be performed again this weekend at the Susan Hess Studio at 2030 Sansom Street in Center City. And if you'd like any information about the performances, you can call 382-8820. Performing, by the way, along with Heath at the piano, was Mary Ellen Grant and Dick DeVoe. Heath, an element of the theater piece that we didn't mention is that there are sayings? What would you call it? Lines by the Chinese philosopher Lao Tzu that are included within the piece, and it's an interesting juxtaposition of Brecht and Lao Tzu.
Mm-hmm.
What connection is there in your mind?
Well, we got to Lao Tzu because at the time Brecht was reading Lao Tzu, and one of the Brecht poems we use is the story of Lao Tzu. And I felt like Lao Tzu was very important to Brecht at this time because it was Lao Tzu that kind of clued him in to the consciousness of being in the moment, but also the Taoist ability to live in paradox, that one could be at the same time in the moment and also at the same time politically active, that you could want to change the world at the same time you were seeing the world as perfect in the way it is. You can live with those kind of paradoxes in Lao Tzu's world. And the other thing for me it was really neat to just set up that kind of chance relationship between the Lao Tzu quotes, which come across on this banner that is physically cranked across the stage, and the Brecht poems. It's kind of like a thing that John Cage might have with his. I mean, it was somewhat intentional what quotes we picked out when. But it's the one element of the play where I'm always being surprised. Even after performing it 20 times, I'll look up and I'll understand something new. I'll have a new revelation about the relationship between the poem, between the Brecht poem and between the Lao Tzu saying. And I think that little element of randomness is for me one of the real magical continually surprising elements of the play.
This sounds like a question for the people who produced the show Meeting of the Minds, but if Lao Tzu and Bertolt Brecht were to be alive and meet one another, do you think they'd get along?
No, not at all. I don't think too many people got along with Bertolt Brecht. Maybe if anybody could, Lao Tzu could, because maybe he could get along with anybody. But I have a feeling not. My attitude has been throughout is that I'm taking this all to serve my purpose. And this is what Brecht did with everybody. I mean, Brecht did this all the time with history. Or with an old play. He'd say, look, I'm going to change it. I'm going to adapt it. I'm going to mess with it. Because I want to make it serve my own what I want to say. And I think I'm Brechting Brecht in that way. There might be a lot of scholars who are saying, oh, you've changed the poems, or you've put music. And a lot of times I make fun of Brecht in the poem. A lot of the humor in the play is me satirizing Brecht. But I think that's my attitude, is to take this stuff, and we want to make our own, the people collaborating, we wanted to make our own statement with this.
You're involved with a new project now. It's called Cultural Harvest, and mm-hmm. you're in residence at the Christian Association
right.
on the Penn campus. Can you tell us a little bit about the project?
Well, it's something that Aaron Williams, who's the co-director with me of Cultural Harvest and also director of the Brecht piece, felt a real need to get some kind of institutional support it just gets very tiresome and very economically unfruitful to be producing one's own work in this city. And we wanted to find some sort of institutional situation where we could go after some foundation money and also have a permanent place of residency where we could do the kind of community-oriented artwork like I described previously with what I was doing at Calvary and doing the workshops that won the Brecht play, which incidentally took place at the Christian Association. So we want to essentially duplicate that interaction between artists and neighborhood people. We have a couple projects coming up. We're going to be doing another play in the spring. Currently, we're under the title of Chairman Mao is a Rotten Egg, which will it's a combination, again, of literature and this time will be people's experiences as children. And it will come out of the same kind of workshop situation that the Brecht play, Reporter Castaway, came out of. And we also want to do some ritual work, like I was doing at Calvary, but on a much larger level. We have some grant money right now. We're trying to get some more to do a large city-wide ritual for the tricentennial this summer. And something we envision with music and giant puppets and maybe a moving cart moving through the street. I mean, that will come out of, that will be developed and work with different people from different neighborhoods in the city and be a collaborative work.
Sounds great. Good luck with your future project.
Thank you.
I've been speaking with Heath Allen, the pianist and composer who's based in Philadelphia, and the piece that we were recently talking about is A Report on a Castaway with music by Heath and poems by Bertolt Brecht. And that will be in performance this weekend at the Susan Hess Studio, which is at 2030 Sansom Street in Center City. For information, you can call 382-8820. That's 382-8820. There will be performances Friday, Saturday evening at 8:30, then a matinee Sunday at 2:30.
And I think we should add that we're having really good crowds last weekend, and so anybody who really wants to go better get there pretty early. By box office opens at 8, so I would advise you to get there right around 8 if you want.
With a reservation?
Sorry.
Well, okay. Well, Heath, nice to see you again. I'm glad you're able to be with us.
Okay, thanks a lot, Terry. It's a pleasure.
It's 24 minutes to 3, and this is Fresh Air on WUHY-FM in Philadelphia. Well, since Heath and I both agreed that, you can't talk about Brecht and music without people automatically thinking of Kurt Weill, why not just go right along with that and hear one of the Kurt Weill Bertolt Brecht collaborations? This is from the Joseph Papp production of Three Penny Opera.
Am I reaching for the sky?
Man has a right in this our brief existence to call some fleeting happiness his own, partake of worldly pleasures and subsistence, and have bread on his table rather than a stone. Such